Blog Talk Radio.
3, 2, 1. The Lincoln Lawyer is back on Netflix's Mega Content Superhighway. Executive producer Ross Feinman joins me next in an internet radio exclusive. Will the writer's strike, entering its third month, become a TV inflection point? Cobra Kai associate producer Zach Arnold elaborates how and why next half hour. Our final 30 minutes previews Moonshine, the dysfunctional family saga reaching the CW tomorrow night from Canada. Our guide, creative and executive producer Sherry Elwood. Also ahead, Susan Rovner is out at NBC Universal under a big executive upheaval. We have the late-breaking details. The 99-cent bundle sale. Our new classic trivia question. And is ESPN close to a cliff dive? I'll comment. Hello, everyone. I'm Simon Applebaum, simulcasting live from New York on Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, and TuneIn Radio, representing the iHeartRadio Podcast Network, the Zencastr Creator Network, and other leading podcast destinations. This just in, tomorrow will be televised. 88 beautiful and hot degrees here in the Big Apple. And on this Thursday afternoon, we welcome you to the program all about TV's current and future. Second of three episodes we're doing this week. Happy to have you aboard wherever you are, joining us from across the country, around the world. We've got a great 2 hours in store for you. So stick around, tell your friends to be part of the program, and you be part of the program too. Give us a call. All you have to do is pick up the phone and dial in with this number, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. The number is good anyway. You're catching us across the country or around the globe here on Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, or TuneIn Radio. And if you're shy about the phone, that's no problem with us because we got a chat room ready to go for you. It's Simon Apple 04 by name, and you will find it at our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. And while the program is on the air, you can connect to others by using Facebook Timeline. Click on the Facebook icon, your Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, or TuneIn screen. Follow the instructions. I'll keep you live with you. Ross Feinman, executive producer of The Lincoln Lawyer, now in Season 2 on Netflix, will join us from Studio City, California, after these news notes. And we begin with a big breaking news story. Susan Rovner's time as NBC Universal's top television executive abruptly ended a few hours ago. Just a short time ago, NBC released a memo from Michael Cavanaugh, who is the current president of Comcast, that's NBC Universal's parent company. He's also the interim NBC Universal president, basically saying Rovner's out. Without explaining why, she, who joined the Comcast-owned subsidiary in 2020 after presiding over Warner Brothers Television, was given her exit mandate. Rovner's responsibilities will be handled by Donna Langley, currently head of Universal Pictures, and now being bumped up to NBC Universal Studio Group head and chief officer. In addition, Mark Lazarus, longtime NBCU executive, also formerly head of NBC Sports, will be bumped up to head of NBC Universal Media Group. And Cesar Conde, currently the key executive at NBC Universal's news operations, will now become head of NBCU News Group, and he will also have oversight responsibilities for Telemundo, the Spanish language network. Matt Strauss will continue to oversee Peacock. That's the latest that we have. Again, Susan Rovner is out as head of content at NBC Universal. She has not released a statement about her situation. And incidentally, in the memo that was distributed to the press about a half hour ago, Cavanaugh said, at the moment, there will not be, repeat, not be, a new head of NBC Universal. How's this for a deal? A bundle of 18 networks from Paramount Plus to Starz for 99 cents a month. Sounds way out? Well, guess what? It's way true and in effect through next Tuesday from Prime Video. You can call an early bird offer from Amazon in advance of their 48-hour Prime Day, which starts July 10th. Other channels packaged in this bundle include AMC Plus and PBS. Each channel would individually be offered from $7.99 to $10.99 a month. Now quickies, former Showtime top executive David Nevins has a new workspace as chief executive of North Road Company, headed by former Showtime chief Peter Chernin. Series produced by North Road include Love is Blind for Netflix, Wahlburgers, and the upcoming Apple TV Plus presentation, Chief of War, starring Jason Momoa. Bravo will offer a 20th anniversary Queer Eye for the Straight Guy marathon July 13th. The event will include a 10-year reunion special with the original hosts. Netflix opens Season 5 of Too Hot to Handle July 14th. And original rom-com Puppy Love premieres on Amazon Freebie August 18th. Lucy Hale, you may remember her as one of the stars of Pretty Little Liars, and Grant Gustin from The Flash, co-star, or co-rom, you call it. And that is news notes for today. Now joining us live in an interview exclusive from Studio City, California, one of the executive producers of Netflix's The Lincoln Lawyer, now in Season 2, Ross Feinman. Ross, congratulations. Welcome to our program.
Thank you very much. Appreciate being here.
How are things going with Season 2, a few hours old on Netflix?
Well, I think we're going to launch in a few hours. It's a great season. I'm really excited about it. you know, I think that season one was fantastic. It was a big hit, and I think we're even better this year.
And you're doing something very unique. This series is based on the popular books by Michael Connelly, who also created Bosch. And rather than take, like, the second book of the series, you're taking the fifth, called The Fifth Witness. Why so?
Well, you know, The Lincoln Lawyer was the first book, and that movie was already done. That case was done. So we wanted to kind of go in order after that, but we did, The Brass Verdict, the first season, which was a really good story. But, you know, you got a lot of books, a lot of great material to pick from, and it just felt like a normal place to go after season one to this story. We're planning the show going, you know, hopefully many seasons, 5, 6, 7 seasons. That's what they told us when they picked this up in Netflix. So we kind of got to plan the right stories for the right year. One of the books changes his position point of view. So we're saving that for later. So this felt like, and that was before this book. So The Fifth Witness felt like the right book at the right time. It's a great story.
And for those who don't know the story of how The Lincoln Lawyer came to be on Netflix, this is another example of Netflix taking a program that either was successful somewhere else or was rejected by somewhere else and has made it their own, whether it's Cobra Kai out of YouTube, whether it's You from Lifetime, or Manifest from NBC, Lucifer from Fox. Same thing here with Lincoln Lawyer. CBS was supposed to present this series several years ago, and they decided in a late call to reject it, despite the pedigree of the show, headed by David E. Kelley, one of the top writer producers in television, and Netflix picked it up. So for those who don't know the story, just explain how Netflix came to get this.
Well, you know, we're on Netflix now, and I'm excited about the future. I would say the history of the project is interesting in that I saw the movie, 11, 12 years ago, something like that, and sometimes you'll see something and it'll give you motivation. It'll inspire you. It'll make you think. As I'm watching the original movie, I really loved the movie, this actually makes a great television series. It was a great setup. It was a great character. It just felt like the right thing to do. And, you know, I got the rights probably, I don't know how many years ago. I got the rights a few years ago. David Kelley and I did. And it just felt like a natural thing to do as a television show. You know, Netflix is ultimately the people that are making it. They had some great ideas. One of the great ideas they had was to go back to the book's roots and make the character true to the book, which was a guy who was half Mexican-American. And that's how we got Manuel involved. He's a great find, really charismatic, terrific actor. And, you know, Matthew McConaughey was great, but he's not the book. Manuel is closer to the book, who the character really is, and we're excited to have him.
And that's Manuel Garcia Rofo. And how does his character develop in this second season?
Well, you know, it's funny. His character is very much, they have a few of the same characteristics, Manuel and Mickey. They're both very passionate people, very charming, very clever. But, you know, Manuel is not an attorney, but he really does his homework on this guy. He really digs deep. He prepares beautifully. But, you know, the character is a very passionate person who, once he buys into one of his clients, he believes in them completely. He doesn't want to think about the person being guilty, because he really, as a backstory for the character, he makes sure, if he's really going to bat to these people, that he has to believe in them. He has to believe that they're good or they're innocent, or at least they're not, you know, obviously guilty. And once he makes that commitment, he's all in. Sometimes it works to advantage, sometimes it works against him. But as a character for television, you know, he just is passionate, smart, committed completely into who he's representing until, you know, sometimes the tables turn. Then he kind of opens his eyes, and then he gets surprised again. That's what's great about the Michael Connelly books, by the way, is the amounts of great twists and turns. You know, you think you're going one way, you go another. You're dedicated to that way, then you twist it again. And that's why these books are so great for television, because there's just so much great story going forward. You never know where it's going to end up.
The Lincoln Lawyer starts its second season today on Netflix, available on smart TV sets, device, and multi-channel bundles, in some cases through your local cable operator. And this season comes in two parts. The first batch of episodes starts now. The second batch of episodes will premiere on August 3rd. We have Ross Feinman, who's one of the executive producers of the series, along with David E. Kelly, Ted Humphries, who also co-developed the series, Michael Connelly, the writer of the original Lincoln Lawyer books, and others. And our guest, Ross, joins us live from Studio City, California, this half hour here on Tomorrow Be Told Live on Thursday afternoon. Happy to have you with us. Simon Applebaum with you live from the other side of the country, Nueva York, where it is 88 degrees and hot and a little bit on the humid side. Hopefully, as the weekend comes around, it will be less humid. And we understand temperatures will be in the lower 80s. If you have a question or comment for Ross, give us a call, 646-652-2906. Or use the chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Prime Video has an exciting new series starring Dusty Machado tomorrow. It's called The Horror of Dolores Roach. Already getting good reviews from Rotten Tomatoes. And we will have an exclusive interview with the creator, co-showrunner, executive producer, Aaron Marks. And then next Monday on Tomorrow Be Televised, we'll get into interactive games and interactive content with the man behind the popular and growing interactive service, Playworks. If you have Roku, you can now watch and play Wheel of Fortune anytime you like on your television set. Jonathan Botak has Playworks. He's got some other exciting things in the works, and he'll tell us about it live as our lead guest. Also, from the hit TNT series, The Lazarus Project, we'll have executive producer Joe Barton. That's all coming up Monday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, exclusively here on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. What was the most interesting feedback that viewers gave you and David and everybody else about the Lincoln Lawyer? How did they identify with the character? Was there anything that particularly surprised you about the viewer response?
You know, I wouldn't say anything surprised me. It's just really satisfying when you get this kind of feedback. You know, I think probably the one thing I probably heard a lot was when people watched the show, they expected Matthew McConaughey or, you know, a blonde surfer, fun, whatever kind of guy. And Manuel's a different kind of guy. He's authentic to Los Angeles, authentic to Southern California. So I think that probably was the one thing that people were a little surprised about. But after a few minutes, you just love this guy. You embrace him. I would say that part of the fun of doing a show like this is, you know, here out in Los Angeles, you know, you're in line at Starbucks and you're hanging out and then you hear people talk about your show, and it's kind of fun just hearing people go on positively about the show. It's a nice kind of a fun little thing to have happen, a little perk of being here in Los Angeles. But I would say that there's no real surprises. You know, Michael Connelly is an amazing writer. His books, you know, he also does Bosch, which is a great show. He's the best. David Kelly, there's nobody like David Kelly at all. He's just, you know, the best drama writer in television today. So you're not surprised when people like your work when you have those two guys with you. You know, the way it goes is I have a deal with A+E Studios with Barry Jossen and Tata Jameson. And, you know, we were looking for some new shows. And when this thing came out, when this book became available, they were all in. They were aggressive. They were generous. They were passionate. And they literally made this happen within a day or two when we found out this is available to us. So they've been great partners for us. But, you know, there's no surprises, really. It's just you expect every show to go well. I guess the surprise is when they do go well. But I'm not surprised this one is because it's, you know, even Ted Humphrey and his co-showrunner, Dalian Rodriguez, they're just like – they're good people. They're good, smart writers. I met with Ted, I don't even know, probably 10, 12 years ago. It was a general meeting. We kind of kept in touch. And when this opportunity came up to work with me and David, I contacted Ted. Ted's a former lawyer himself. He knew the books well. I think his sister is a prosecutor. And she also knew the books and was, you know, they would talk about the books like their own little book club. And when the opportunity came up, Ted was all over it. Met a lot of people. Ted was clear and by far the best guy to do this with us. And, you know, he writes compelling stories along with David. So long way of saying no real surprises.
Mm-hmm. At the beginning of producing the second season, did you and David and Ted and everybody sort of gather together and say, how do we make sure that our second season grows the show rather than takes it into the dreaded sophomore slump?
Well, a lot of, you know, a lot of thought went into which book would be next, right? And that's part of what your initial question was, how'd you pick this book? You know, they're all compelling, but this one really felt like it was going to take Mickey to another level. It was, you know, he's got to work on his success from season one and his newfound fame of becoming, you know, quote unquote, the Lincoln lawyer. You know, he's got a lot going on this year where there's more, he's trying to hold on to his marriage, which is over. He's trying not to make it over with Nev Campbell, who's amazing. He's got a new love in his life because that one, the old one isn't quite working out. So you see more of his passion, you see more of his personal life. You get more of, you know, what is working in his personal life and what is not working, as well as what's working in his professional life and what's not working. They collide all the time. His second ex-wife, played by Becky Newton, is also, you know, works in his office. So he just can't get away from his ex-wives and doesn't really want to. But I'd say the second season on this book specifically is even more twists and turns. Since we met the character in season one, now that you know and you love him, there's more fun to be had with the fifth witness.
Mm-hmm. Given where the pandemic was last year compared to what it was the first year of production, was it easier to technically produce season two?
Oh, yeah. Season one, but the pandemic was very difficult. You know, we were one of the first shows in Los Angeles up and running when the pandemic was, you know, at its worst. You know, it's making a television show, you know, you see, you know, a few characters on screen, but there's hundreds of support people, not just the studio, but the people on set, you know, all the people that supplied the people on set. There's just so much going on there. And with, you know, Zone A, Zone B, Zone C, with people wearing masks, with people have to get tested, with some people getting sick, it was a real challenge. We never had one down day, though. We never had anybody in our cast get COVID. Nobody in our crew got COVID that was working the days that they were supposed to. So we really got very lucky, but it was very challenging. Year two, season two also, some challenges with COVID, but less so because we got used to it. And there was, you know, people coming back from year one. So it was a little smoother, but man, year one was really a challenge. But I have to say that, you know, our producers and on down, everybody had great work ethic. You know, it's when you're number one, you know, Manuel is such a good guy and cares so much. It's hard for the people not to feel the same. It's contagious. So with a guy like Manuel leading the charge, everybody else was in a great mood. Everybody else wanted to try hard. Everybody else was committed to doing a great show, and I think it shows.
In a second season, how much can you take creative risks because of what you learned about the first season? For example, you can say to Manuel's character, we can take him to be more fish out of water in this environment versus that environment, or we can do something different in, let's say, for a particular episode to either cinematography in a certain way or try something in terms of multiple plot lines, let's say, or as Hill Street views to do, we'll do like three or four plot lines running over four or five episodes, and then we'll wrap them all up. You know, we'll start them all in episode one and wrap them all up in season four or five. I mean, episode four or five.
Yeah. You know, there are definitely risks you can take. You need to be true to the character. He's not all of a sudden going to be a chain-smoking, conniver. He is who he is. But you can definitely take risks with the character. Go outside of your comfort zone. The show, you know, the way it's written and the way our writers do it, it's great. It compels you from episode one to episode two to episode three. We all consume shows like that now. We all, even though you still watch network shows, we all like to watch shows, you know, back to back to back at home if we can. And it's just too easy to say I'm bored or not go to the next episode. And I think our show compels you to the next episode really nicely. There's always a nice cliffhanger, whether it's personal or professional in his life. But you got to take chances because if you're too safe, then it just becomes predictable. And the show is not predictable. The character is not predictable. And we're going more into his personal life. We're going more into his love life. But also, we're bringing back some of these stories that were kind of left hanging from season one. you know, there's a couple of big storylines from season one that are going to get paid off in season two. So you need to do that. But, you know, you got to take risks. You got to open up more, and we're going to do that hopefully every season to come.
Ross Byman, executive producer of The Lincoln Lawyer on Netflix. He's our guest this half hour on Tomorrow Be Televised from Studio City, California. Lincoln Lawyer just started season number two on Netflix, available on smart sets, smart devices, multi-channel bundles, and some places through your local cable operator. And for question or comment for Ross in our final minutes with him, make that call right now, 646-652-2906, or use the chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Coming up in our next half hour, we'll be joined by an associate producer on another Netflix series, the popular Cobra Kai, which hopes to wrap up its run there in 2024. He's been following the writer's strike a lot, and he has some very interesting points about where he thinks that is going to go and whether or not it could be a major inflection point for television. He also has started his own firm called Optimize Yourself, and we'll hear all about that, too. That's in our next half hour. Ross, what's it like working with Nev Campbell, who we've seen so many different sides of her over the decades, from Party of Five to films to other television shows?
I'm sorry, what did you ask about her?
What's it like to work with Nev Campbell and show a different side of her? Because over the decades, we've seen her in so many different film and TV roles.
Nev is a fan person. She's a great actor and even a better person. She's lovely. She's smart. She's considerate. There's no star power, no star ego about her. She has star power, but no star ego. She's just committed. She's such a good person. She's such a good person to work with Manuel. You know, Manuel's not a known person. She's very well known, and it's called The Lincoln Lawyer. So de facto, she's not the lead of the show, but she helps him with what the scenes they're in. She works well with him. She's a fantastic partner to have, both for the actors, for me as an executive producer. I was just, communicating with her this morning. She's really happy about season two. She's lovely. We live in the same neighborhood, and I bumped into her in the market a few months ago, and my wife, and I saw somebody hundreds of feet away, having their picture taken. I said, honey, I think that might be Nev. And then we made eye contact. She ran over with one of her kids, and she was just lovely and just kind of like, just a regular mom at the shopping mart. But, on set, she's a total pro. She's the nicest person you can imagine. She's great.
Somebody else that you have on The Lincoln Lawyer, at least for this season, is somebody I met way, way, way back when, I believe when I was at either Cablevision Magazine or Cable Magazine as a senior editor, and I think she was on Third Watch on NBC. That's Lana Parrilla, who has been in so many different series. She really made it big with Once Upon a Time, the series on ABC. We had the executive producers on the first year that was on. It ran for several seasons. What's it like working with her and some of the other people that are coming into play this season?
Lana is new to the show this season. She is, I'm not trying to sound Pollyanna and like a broken record. She couldn't be better. She's so nice. I wouldn't say she was nervous, but she wanted to get it right because she was coming onto a show that was, perceived to be a hit. Well, it is a hit. And she just was so prepared and such a good person. And she's just lovely to have on set. She is she's the consummate pro. Yeah, she's got you wouldn't know it by looking at her, but she's got a long career. And she's great in the role. Also we have Yaya DaCosta, who works in a lot of the scenes with her as well. And Yaya, again, smart, ambitious, total pro. There was one day I was on set, and Yaya, she was losing her voice. She wasn't sick. She just was losing her voice. And they were running through, and I was really worried. We have to either, cut the scene that day or, do voiceover, whatever. But she asked for at lunch, she'd be ready. She came back, and my God, she was on it. She was strong. She was loud and proud. And after the scene was over, then she started to lose her voice again, but she really geared up for it. So, new people like Yaya and Lana, are great additions. And, I'm glad we got them both.
Somebody else I just saw that you also have, I believe she is a very popular telenovela star on Spanish language television, Angelica Maria.
She's larger than life. She's a lot of fun. She kind of plays that character, actually, on the show, right? The teledevelop actress. It was a hard role to find. We really had to go deep to get the right person because she had to be kind of opposite of Mickey. She has to be larger than life because Mickey is kind of close to he's charming, but he's not an outwardly aggressive person. And she is just larger than life, and you know, she just sucks up, in a good way, sucks up all the oxygen in the room. And when we saw her audition, I was like, okay, she's obviously the one. And it came down to like the last minute, and she was totally prepared, ready to go. She brought another level to the character that you would only hope to get. She's amazing. I hope she's with us the rest of the run.
When you have people like David E. Kelley and Ted Humphrey and Barry Jostin from A&E Studios and Michael Connelly, the creator of this whole franchise, how do you make sure as an executive producer working with them that everybody's vision is unified, that everybody is on the same, I know it's a cliche, but let's use it, page?
Well, you know, every show, I think, starts with the hope that they're all going to be the same page, they're all going to have the same vision, it's all going to be great, and sometimes that doesn't happen, sometimes it does. You know, again, David is, he's the best television writer alive today. It's just his body of work, the quality of his work, the stuff he's still doing today, he's amazing. So when he writes a script, the characters are very well defined. The story makes sense. You don't have to ask yourself what's happening. You know what's happening. And we brought Ted on. You know, he and David got along really well. They had a shared vision, and it just works that way. Connelly is so supportive. He also writes scripts. He's in the writer's room a lot. He's a definite presence of the show. He's not precious. Like, just because he wrote something doesn't mean you have to use it or can't change it. He's really open to that. He's a great sounding board. You know, and Barry Jostin, who heads up the studio, is extremely supportive creatively. You know, you can't ask for a better partner that way because, you know, Barry knows both physical production as well as creative. And he's able to speak, you know, both really well. He's very supportive. He's supportive of David, what he wants to do. He's supportive of me and Ted and Connelly. And you just hope when you get all these people in a room together, it jives, and it does. I think it's kind of obvious on screen that we're having a good time. And again, I hate to sound like a broken record. I think we got a lot of years ahead of us because we just got lucky how these people came together on the right project at the right time.
Ross, two more questions before we go. First, in this second season, do we get to see more about how the character's Latino heritage or Latino culture or a Latino environment influences his thinking, his decisions as a lawyer?
I'm not sure it colors his decisions, but sure, we definitely get into that part of it. I mean, like, he's in the backstory, you know, he's from California, but also his mother is from Mexico, so he went back and forth as a child. But we definitely service a lot of his Hispanic roots and how he lives his life and where he is, you know. I think Los Angeles is just a big fishbowl, you know, and there's all types of people here. And we don't go out of our way to point a laser on it, but it's definitely present. You know, we have all types of people in our show. You know, it's very diverse. But I would say that Manuel, he definitely has a good portion of his Hispanic roots along with his, you know, Los Angelino roots. That's what Michael Connelly brings to this, by the way, is his characters in this show and other books he writes are very, very deep into Los Angeles being a character. LA is you can't deny that, you know, the Hispanic portion of Los Angeles, it just goes hand in hand. And Los Angeles is a big character, and we go to some really fun places along the way. It's very colorful. We had some great directors this year. And we had great DP, couple of great DPs who made just made it look beautiful. I'd say that it's as interesting with the sound off as it is with the sound on, even though you want to keep the sound on, but it's great to look at as well.
Mm-hmm. And we'll end on this. Have you heard back from the Ford Motor Company? Any thoughts they have about how the Lincoln cars that you use, how they're used?
They don't call me. I'm sure it's helping them somewhat, but they're not, you know. The Lincoln lawyer itself, the old Lincoln car is a great car. The old convertible is a really fun, sweet car. We have a couple of them. It's beautiful. It's a tank to drive. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we went through kind of figure out which cars he was going to drive. It just kind of made sense to use the one, the bigger car he has and the old convertible he uses. But, you know, Ford hasn't called me.
If you watch the trailer, those Lincolns look great going down those coastal highways with the Pacific Ocean in the background. The Lincoln Lawyer, Season 2, now on Netflix. First batch of episodes now. Second batch of episodes will premiere on August 3rd, and you can find Netflix on smart TV sets, smart TV devices, multi-channel bundles, and in some places, your local cable operator. For more details about the service and the program online, go to Netflix.com. That's Netflix.com. Lincoln Lawyer, Season 2, now on Netflix. Russ Feinman, executive producer of the program, thank you again for joining us. Congratulations on Season 2 getting off the ground today, and hopefully many more seasons to come. It has been a great time having you on.
Thank you, Simon. Nice to talk to you. I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome. Take care. Have a great rest of the week and a super weekend.
You too. Thank you.
Russ Feinman, executive producer of The Lincoln Lawyer, joining us live from Studio City, California. When we come back, Cobra Kai associate producer Zach Arnold joins us. We'll get his very unique perspective on the writer's strike and what it could mean for television after we pause after the bottom of the hour for web identification. This is the best internet radio on the planet, www.blogtalkradio.com, speaker.com, tune.com, together reaching over 85 million listeners around the world every month and growing. BTR is your home for the After Six Cruise Mix. That's tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific. Great music and conversation for you. The After Six Cruise Mix at tonight, 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific, the After Six Cruise Mix right here on Blog Talk Radio. And don't forget, Best BTR 24/7 at YouTube.com. Welcome back to more of this two-hour edition of Tomorrow Be Televised, coming away on a Thursday afternoon, live in vivo from Nueva York. Simon, I've been with you along for the ride. If you have a question or comment in our remaining hour and a half with our guests, give us a call, 646-652-2906, or use the chat room, SimonApple04 by name. My next guest has a number of credits to his credit. He is associate producer of the popular Netflix series Cobra Kai, which will be going into its final season hopefully next year on Netflix. He is also the head of a brand new venture called Optimize Yourself. And he has some very interesting perspective, which is about to give on the state of the writer's strike, which this week enters its third month. Joining us live from Los Angeles, an interview exclusive, Zach Arnold. Zach, welcome in. Hang on for 1 second. We will get him shortly. Let's try again. And Zach, go right ahead. You're on.
Yeah, I'm here. So I just wanted to thank you for this opportunity. Really looking forward to having this conversation.
Same here. Let's get right to it. The writer's strike is now entering its third month, and you say that this could be an inflection point for television. How so?
Yeah, so this is definitely an inflection point in so much as I've been saying that this is a once-in-a-generation reckoning for the way that Hollywood does business with all of its creatives, writers being a part of that. One caveat that I want to give to the audience is that with the title associate producer, that can cover a wide gamut and a lot of perspectives in the industry. I come at this from the editor perspective. So I've been an editor in the industry for about 25 years, doing a multitude of features and television series, Cobra Kai obviously being the most recent. So I just want to make sure people are very clear. I am not a member of the WGA. I'm not a working writer, although most people call the editors as the final writer of the process, so to speak. But I'm coming at this very much as an outside perspective and a below-the-line perspective. But I'm still very entrenched in multiple sides of the industry, both with my students and the work that I do. But I wanted to make sure to frame that properly, that nobody gets the idea that I'm coming at it from the writer's perspective. But I think that whether it's the writer's needs, whether it's the actor's needs who are potentially, you know, going to go into their own strike, or whether it's all the other below-the-line or above-the-line crafts, I really think that this writer's strike is representative of a once-in-a-generation reckoning for how the industry does work with its creatives and how it exploits us as widgets rather than human beings to bring value where they respect us.
Have you seen the picket lines for yourself where you are? And if so, how do you characterize the way the writers are showing themselves on those lines?
Yeah, so I've definitely seen the picket lines. I've driven by them. I've actually, the side story, either been on vacation or had COVID for the last month and a half. So between those two things, I haven't been able to be on a picket line myself, but I've certainly driven by them. I've seen plenty of pictures. I've talked to people on the picket lines. And what I'm seeing different from the last strike that I went through in 2007 and from talking to many other people is that there's a solidarity amongst not only the writers, but amongst many other crafts that we really haven't seen before, whether it's now that the, you know, the other labor unions, even outside of the industry, like hotel workers, they showed up on the lines. You've got directors, you've got editors, you've got cinematographers, you have people from all of the other various guilds and unions that are standing by the writers. And I think that what causes so much strife and so much conflict with these strikes in general, and this is something that the studios and the AMPTP is very good at, is pitting all of the various guilds and unions against each other and making it, well, this is what we need, but what they need is different, and we're going to fight for ourselves. And I feel like for the most part, they haven't been able to divide us yet. And there's just been this real solidarity and this unification that goes far beyond just the writers, where we all see that what the writers are fighting for is representative of what we're all fighting for. So to me, if anything is going to change in the industry, and if this is going to be a true inflection point rather than just hitting the pause button before we unfortunately go back to our version of normal, if this is going to be an inflection point, it's going to take everybody across all the guilds and multiple unions to collectively decide the way we're being treated and the way that we negotiate these deals and the way that we're compensated is no longer acceptable. Because if we do continue to be if we continue to be divided in our guilds and in our various unions, then it's just going to be more of the status quo, which frankly is killing all of us.
Mm-hmm. If you have a question or comment for our guest, Zach Arnold, associate producer on Cobra Kai, we'll also talk to him shortly about his new venture, Optimize Yourself. Give us a call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Zach, when we have reported on this strike over the last 2 months plus, I've often used as a metaphor the episode of The Twilight Zone that Rod Serling wrote called The Obsolete Man. And for those who don't know the episode, it stars Burgess Meredith as a librarian of future society where he is deemed obsolete. And he has to choose the way to be liquidated. And it won't go beyond. It's a wonderful performance and a wonderful wonderful episode. The sense I got from seeing the people on the picket line here in New York, especially during the upfront events in mid-May, is that there's a sense that they feel, especially with artificial intelligence as a major subject, that if they don't get the deal that they believe they want, they're going to be deemed obsolete. Because of AI, because of the way writers' rooms are set up, because of mini rooms, because of residuals not being gotten from or not being gotten the way they'd like from the mega content services like Netflix and Hulu and Prime Video and so on and so forth. How would you assess that?
Yeah, so I think that there's no question that if you're looking at all of the major conversation points and the reason that the writers are fighting and the reason that so many other guilds and unions are standing behind them, AI is definitely one of the top three, if not the very top of that list, with probably streaming residuals being a close number two. And for the writers, it would be the mini rooms. For the actors, it would be the self-tapes, which really boils down to the exploitation of our hours and our talents. But really, I think AI is at the forefront of this negotiation. Just as, you know, similar inflection points of technology, other technologies have been at that forefront. And I think that the point that's missed, and I think that this is the piece that both sides of the negotiating table need to think about, and that everybody that's a craft person in the industry needs to think about, I don't believe there is a future without AI. There isn't a world where we say in our contracts, we are not allowed to use AI. I think that the choice that we have right now is either the AI works for us or we work for the AI. I think that's the conversation that we need to be having, and there needs to be plenty of regulations and stipulations, whatever is necessary to make sure that we integrate AI into the creative process, but we as humans are still driving it and we're using it as a tool that enhances our ability to tell stories. Because the idea of, well, if AI can replace us, therefore we can't use AI, that argument is saying in and of itself, we are replaceable. And I don't believe that as creatives we are replaceable, whether it's as editors, whether it's as writers, whether it's as cinematographers, actors, whatever it might be, I don't believe that we are replaceable, but I think that trying to advocate for the abolition or the restriction of AI being a part of the process is a mistake. We need to embrace it, but we need to control it and regulate it so it's a tool that helps us, the humans, make our stories better, as opposed to, like for me as an editor, for example, the last thing that I want to happen is for somebody else or for some AI tool to do the majority of the editing choices. And I just come in for the final pass, and I'm essentially polishing with an otherwise digital turd. That doesn't interest me. I want to be able to use AI as a tool to make my life easier and to make my storytelling better. So I believe if there ever was a time that we need to talk about AI and we need to get on the picket lines and we need to stop the industry for a good reason, it's this one. Because if we don't, 5 or 10 years down the line, nobody's going to be working on sets because sets are no longer necessary because one person is creating everything, prompting it from AI versus all of us working together to embrace AI as a storytelling tool, making our lives easier and making our stories better. But if the argument is no AI, keep it out of our industry, I just don't think that that's a valid argument. And I don't think that there's any way to get in the, to stand between the exponential speed and rise of AI just in our society and our culture. It would have been like saying 25 years ago, well, we prefer to not use the internet. We want to continue using libraries and our research. Nobody's going to stop the growth of the internet. And I feel that AI is the same thing, but it's happening so much faster at an exponential rate that we don't even understand where AI can be in 3 years when there would be a next negotiation. So I think the writers and the actors and the directors are absolutely right to draw the line in the sand and say this is where the conversation must start.
Hey, given though how nebulous AI is, and as you just mentioned, how fast the developments are coming from all sides, even though there is now this general agreement that AI is going to have a role in terms of how television is created, produced, and presented to people, you know, our listeners and viewers, how specific can that line be drawn in the sand? And I raise this also because when the Directors Guild made their deal, which was approved, ratified by 87% of the membership, even though it had some specifics about AI, like, for example, we consider you a person. We don't consider AI a person. And no matter what, you will, you know, we're not gonna fire you. You're not gonna be, you know, blasted to the Phantom Zone. How specific can the writers get in this new contract and still be flexible for the Alliance to deal with, the Alliance of TV and Film Producers to deal with what they got to deal with as this artificial intelligence world shapes up?
I think you're absolutely asking the right question, and I'm going to be perfectly honest that I don't have the perfect answer, but I think that the first thing to clarify is that when it comes to the specific technologies that are being used, for example, as an editor, if you said, well, what are the 5 best AI tools to make and edit a movie, I have no clue, not my area of expertise. From a legal perspective, if you said, how do we legally protect ourselves from AI, I also don't have the legal expertise. But I think at the end of the day, whether it's the writers, whether it's the directors, whether it's, you know, I as an editor being a part of IAPI, for example, I think it really comes down to ownership. Who owns the ideas and who owns the choices? Because at my level, being an editor and being an associate producer on a show like Cobra Kai, I am not hired on that show to edit and produce because I'm competent, because I know Avid Media Composer, because I understand how to take raw dailies and cut them into scenes. There are thousands of people that have a level of competence at my level or frankly even above, and they'd be able to cut that show. The reason that I've been hired to cut that show is they trust my ability to make the right decisions and they trust my opinions. Because my point of view is very specific to the tone and the objective and the deeper why of the show Cobra Kai. So that's the reason that they hire me versus thousands of other people that are competent. So if I wanted to go in and I wanted to use AI to make different editorial choices or faster choices, but I'm the one that's prompting it and I'm driving it as opposed to it driving me, I don't have any problem with it becoming another tool that makes our jobs more efficient or more effective. From the writer's perspective, for example, there's a major difference between a studio executive asking ChatGPT, give me 10 different story pitches for a show with these characters that's going to be a multi-camera sitcom for 30 minutes and break out a 22-episode show Bible, print that out and hand it to a writer and say, flesh this out. The owner of that idea is the AI coupled with the studio executive. To me, that's unacceptable. But if a studio executive says to a writer, I want you to pitch me story ideas, and the writer wants to use a tool like ChatGPT or something else just to flesh out ideas and brainstorm and throw some spaghetti against the wall creatively to see what sticks, I personally don't have a problem with that. So for me, it's all about ownership. Who owns the ideas and who controls the ideas? And if AI is a tool that we can use to generate and brainstorm and do cooler things, I personally am all for that. But at the end of the day, we can't start with AI and we can't give AI any ownership of these ideas or of these creative choices.
Has it surprised you that both sides are not being public about what they would like to see or in any effort to get back to the bargaining table? In the case of the Alliance of TV and Motion Picture Producers, we've invited them to make their case on this program. They are not talking. They're not talking to us. They're not talking to TV's Top 5 of the Hollywood Report. They're not talking to anybody about their side of the story. On the side of the writers, we've invited them to give us their side of the story or to at least, you know, express a willingness to get back to the bargaining table in line of the Directors Guild deal and what is going on now with the Screen Actors Guild in terms of the overtime and after, in terms of the overtime on their talks. And also explain their actions in terms of playing havoc with things like the Tony Awards, the Emmys, the Daytime Emmys, so on and so forth. Why are we seeing this lack of anybody, you know, getting what they need to say out in public so that they can be brought back to the bargaining table?
Yeah, so, well, first of all, I'm going to be coming at this from complete speculation. I don't have any insider information other than my own personal educated opinions from being in the industry. From the standpoint of the AMPTP, I would speculate that it's because they're in the middle of a series of other ongoing negotiations, whether it's just finishing with the DGA or now very actively involved with SAG-AFTRA. And I think that it's, from their perspective, it's all largely the same conversation. And my guess is they have to be very, very careful about anything that gets out there, because even if they're technically saying something about the writer's strike, it can be taken out of context, and the same could be said about the SAG strike or any other upcoming labor negotiation. So it doesn't surprise me that they're being cagey. I, like you, would prefer a lot more transparency and that we could all just be human beings about this and we could resolve this conflict. But unfortunately, that's not the way that it works in the industry. And as far as the writers are concerned, I honestly don't know why they wouldn't want to come on and be more vocal, because I feel that they've done very good with their PR machine in releasing videos and sharing their standpoints. And anybody can go on the WGA website without any login information whatsoever, and you can see a breakdown of every single deal point that they proposed. And you can see either the counter proposal from the AMPTP, or you can see that they just rejected the proposal altogether. So as far as transparency, with a click of a button, you can literally see where the negotiations stand from the writer's perspective and what has or hasn't been addressed from the AMPTP. So why they wouldn't come on, I would totally have to speculate, and I don't know. But I think that in the day and age that we are with social media and with things, once it goes out into the world, there's no taking it back, especially with live talk radio. I think that people have to be so incredibly careful about exactly what they say and how they say it, that if one thing comes out wrong, it could destroy the landscape of the story that's being told, the larger narrative. So I can see how they'd be hesitant.
Well, before we move on with one more question, I do want to, again, invite if the Alliance of Motion Picture and TV Producers, if the Writers Guild people like Warren Lake, for example, who's been very vocal on Twitter in New York, the former head of the former executive producer of Law and Order Special Victims Unit, who's been on our show twice, would like to come on, or somebody else from the Guild or from the Alliance, we would love to have on this program. Like I've said before, you know, you can't if you want to get back to the bargaining table, you got to get out there and be public. You know, let folks know. That's when you have conversations get handled in public, that's when things start to move. So before we go on to other things that you're involved with, Zach, if the Screen Actors Guild and AFTRA make a deal with the Alliance, would that, depending on what the terms are, would that get everybody back to the bargaining table?
Again, this is coming from a complete point of speculation, but I do think that the writers are going to be in a relatively difficult position if SAG-AFTRA does settle. And I have no insider information whatsoever, once again. But just understanding basic negotiations and basic human behavior, logic just seems to dictate that if they decided to extend their negotiations by 2 additional weeks, there has to be a reason for that. If they were so far apart at the table on June 30th, that they decided there's no way this is going anywhere, I don't think they would have extended it. And it sounds like they have a lot of work to do and a lot of deal points to hammer out. But my speculation is that we have a higher than 50% likelihood that they probably will settle by their July 12th deadline. If that does happen, I think it puts the writers in a very precarious position, because you now have two major unions that have settled very, very similar negotiations, both regarding AI and regarding streaming, and even though it's not in exactly the same wordage, when it's the self-tapes for the actors, that's a very similar argument that the writers have about their mini rooms. If all of these are settled, now the AMPTP has established a pattern between their directors and their actors, and I think the narrative is going to be much more challenging for the writers to be asking for something significantly different or better if the other two major unions have acquiesced, especially considering that essentially this is COVID shutdown 2.0, where 3 years ago the industry shuts down, everybody's living off of their savings, we just get back to work, and now all of a sudden we're in the same position again. People are desperate to get back to work and desperate to have a regular paycheck and desperate to be out of their houses and doing the work that they so desperately want to do and love to do. So I think that the narrative and the pressure is going to be very much towards wanting the writers to strike a deal sooner rather than later. However, if SAG-AFTRA does indeed decide to go on strike, I think we're in for a long, hard-fought battle where the two of them are going to band together. And, I mean, this could potentially go until the end of the year. But, again, this is all speculation. But I'll be surprised if we don't see some form of a resolution fairly soon for SAG-AFTRA, which, again, I think hopefully, at least from the standpoint of going back to work, that it's going to benefit both the writers and benefit everybody else. But I'm of the mindset that this is a much larger game and we need to play a game of chess and we need to change what the status quo is. And we need to be valued and respected for what we as craftspeople bring to the table. And if a project is successful, we need to reap in the benefits of that success. And however long it takes to change the paradigm, I'm all for it. But if SAG-AFTRA settles, I think we're going to probably see some form of a settlement from the writers sooner rather than later. But again, totally speculating from a below-the-line perspective.
In a moment, we'll talk to Zach Arnold about his venture known as Optimize Yourself and where things stand with the final season of Cobra Kai, now expected to come on Netflix in 2023. Request your comment and maintenance with Zach. Give us a call, 646-652-2906, or use the chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Coming up in our second hour, we'll have our new classic trivia question and new prize in play, maybe a second prize too. Plus, I'll have a comment about the situation at ESPN. Is ESPN close to falling off a cliff? They may very well be. We'll explain why, especially in light of the layoffs, or what they're calling Black Friday over there, that took place last week. And still drips and drabs are coming out in various media. And also, in our second hour, we will go live to Canada, and we will hopefully be talking with Sherry Elwood. She is the creator and executive producer of Moonshine. That's the brand new series by a dysfunctional family. It's a series that deals, from what I understand, with Lust, Legacy, and Lobster. It premieres tomorrow night at 9 p.m. Pacific time on the CW. Sherry Elwood, creator and executive producer, joining us in our final 30 minutes. That's all ahead here on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Zach, talk about Optimize Yourself. How did you decide to start this venture? What does it do?
Yeah, so Optimize Yourself came to be because I saw specifically the way that editors and other craftspeople in the industry were being exploited and were constantly burned out. And we're at the point where we are so focused on optimizing our technology and our hard drive speeds and becoming more efficient, but we're not focusing on what is the most effective operating system we have, which is our bodies and our minds. So what I did was I built this learning platform and this educational community whereby I teach all of the necessary life skills and human skills that the educational institutes don't teach us, whether it's time management, whether it's networking, and most importantly, how to design your own career path in this day and age of the gig economy, so that people actually have a resource to be able to design the more balanced, more sustainable, and more fulfilling creative careers that they deserve. And in this day and age especially, I think that this strike just speaks to this inflection point where we are all learning, whether it's this work stoppage or even like you said with these Black Friday layoffs at ESPN, what we're seeing is the evolution of our entire society and culture to the gig economy. So everybody that learned one specialized skill or craft in college and said, this is the path that I'm going to be on, and I'm going to climb from the bottom of the career ladder to the top of the career ladder, what we're realizing is that there is no more career ladder. There is an infinite number of paths that we can travel, and statistically, between graduating college and retirement, most people make 3 to 5 major career transitions, but nobody is educated for how to actually navigate those career transitions. So what I do is I help specifically creative professionals, storytellers, writers, editors, composers, learn how they can take their unique skill set, their passions and their interests, and their past experience to really broaden their knowledge and broaden their opportunities, because especially with the advent of artificial intelligence, I think the days of being a specialist are over, and I think what we're seeing now is the rise of the generalist. So those are the educational resources in the community that I provide are for those who want to build the more balanced, sustainable, and fulfilling creative career.
How many people do you work with right now?
My current semester, I've got about 150 students at any given time. I've got, you know, thousands of podcast listeners and, you know, newsletter subscribers all over the world on six continents. But give or take any semester, I've got about between 100 and 150 students and hoping to grow that. But it's not a matter of these are just Los Angeles industry professionals. I've got students all over the world that are doing a variety of creative professions. I've got quite a few students that are in New York, as a matter of fact, but it's not just editors. It's people in all various crafts inside and outside the entertainment industry. But yeah, currently I'm working with about 150 students this semester, which in and of itself is a full-time job, not to mention also trying to, you know, balance my time with Cobra Kai and a family.
Before you go, let's get some words in about the status of Cobra Kai. I understand the production has been stopped on the sixth and final season due to the writer's strike. Where do things stand, and does it look like we will get that final season next year?
I mean, to my knowledge, as far as I understand it, and by the way, I'm below the line, I'm completely out of the loop, but as I understand it, there's no reason that we wouldn't get the final season, the sixth season of Cobra Kai, at some point next year. I have no idea what the release calendars are going to look like. And frankly, if you were to talk to the head network executive at both Sony and Netflix, they would both probably tell you, we have no idea what's going on right now. But I know for a fact that, you know, as they've announced it publicly, there will be a sixth season of Cobra Kai. And as it also has been announced publicly shortly after the start of production on season six, because of the writer's strike, everything is shut down and is halted. So outside of that, I frankly know very little more or any more than anybody else does. So I'm sitting and waiting in anticipation, just like everybody else is, because I'm a huge fan of the show. That's why I decided to work on it. So I'm on pins and needles, just like everybody else, waiting for this final season to come out.
Well, why do you think Cobra Kai has had a great run? And like The Lincoln Lawyer, which was rejected by CBS, it's now in its second season on Netflix, which started today. Why Netflix has had success taking shows from other places, like Cobra Kai from YouTube, like You from Lifetime, like Manifest from NBC, like Lucifer from Fox, and they seem to get not just a second life, but a big second life, or a better second life through that service.
Yeah, well, I think that, first of all, I think that Cobra Kai resonated so much, number one, because it tapped into an existing IP with The Karate Kid, and that is a universal story that's essentially timeless. This idea of the underdog overcoming all odds, especially the underdog that's being taken advantage of, that's being bullied, we've all felt like that at some point in our lives, and I think that that theme resonates across time. And I think that the reason that Cobra Kai hit so well at the right time is because, unlike a lot of remakes or a lot of repurposing of old properties, they were very, very honorable, and they respected the old source material, but they also added a whole new twist to it. So I, first of all, think that just the success of Cobra Kai in general as a, you know, as a story and as a show is because the three creators of the show, John Hurwitz, Josh Heald, and Hayden Schlossberg, they're absolute geniuses at understanding both the original source material but how to blend it with new ideas and give it a fresh perspective that feel like you're in the same world. But when it comes to the YouTube versus Netflix transition, I was there when all of that happened, and we had edited and finished and delivered all season three, having no idea if anybody would ever see it. And what we saw was when it was on YouTube for the first two seasons, it was very, very few people actually knew about the show, but those that did were die-hard fans. They were obsessed with the show. They watched it multiple times. They knew every character. I mean, you saw fandom to the same level as a Star Trek or a Star Wars. People are this obsessed about it. But the problem was the general public wasn't aware of it. So it was all the old fanboys and all the people that loved the fact that it was from the 80s. And then all of a sudden you bring it to Netflix. And now I'm going to dinners and lunches with my in-laws, and my parents and my grandparents are saying, oh my God, I love Cobra Kai. This is such a great show. That was the Netflix effect. Netflix didn't all of a sudden take a show that wasn't working and make it work. They helped us amplify a show that was already working well, and Netflix also has an amazing marketing and publicity department. So the quality of the advertising, the one-sheets, the trailers, the promos, the teasers was completely leveled up with Netflix. So when you take the level of their subscriber base and then you take the power of their algorithm, and then you take how good they are at marketing publicity. It was just kind of the perfect storm in all the best ways possible to take a show that was already resonating with the right people and just amplifying it to a much larger mass public. And it's been really fun to watch it go from a show where people say it's what show? They're doing a Karate Kid and it's on the YouTubes to, oh yeah, I love this show. I watch it on Netflix all the time. It's been really fun to watch that transition and be a part of Netflix for that process.
Zach, before you go, once this writer's strike is over and everything is now moved to the next level, is there a upcoming series that you would like to be on as an editor?
To be honest, I've pretty much dedicated myself now full-time to building and growing Optimize Yourself, because having 150 students and building multiple online courses and cohort-based classes and doing executive coaching and everything else, there's only so many hours in the day, and that's pretty much taking up all of those hours. If there were one show that would be my next dream job to put it out there, would be working on the Apple Plus TV show Severance. I'm absolutely obsessed with Severance. I actually had the creator of Severance on my podcast, Dan Erickson. I had a great conversation about the genesis of that show, and he very much was an underdog story overcoming the odds to get that on Apple TV. But, yeah, if there were one show that if I were still going to edit and go on my next series, I would do everything I could to be able to work on Severance.
That opening title, by the way, is sensational.
Everything about that show is sensational.
That opening title was sensational.
Yeah, no, I've been saying that if Severance continues to work at the level that it did in season one, which is a very big ask of any TV series because it's hard over the course of multiple seasons to stay that consistent. If it's as consistently good as season one, I think when it's over, it's going to be in the same conversation as Breaking Bad.
And before we go, I also mentioned that Optimize Yourself has a number of books that our guest has written. One of them is called The Ultimate Guide to Making in Hollywood. We're going to see if we can offer that as a classic trivia prize. So just to let you know, if you want to know more about Optimize Yourself and what Zach Arnold is doing, here's where you go online. It's optimizeyourself.me. Love that finish after the dot. Optimize Yourself, M-E. And Cobra Kai is expected to have its sixth and final season, everything considered, next year, 2024, on Netflix. Available again on smart TV sets, devices, and multi-channel bundles. For more details online, go to Netflix.com. It's Netflix.com. Zach Garneau, thank you very much for joining us. Thank you for your perspective on the writer's strike. Let's hope that, the Actors Union and the Alliance get their heads together and work the deal out in the next week, and then from there we start to see, hopefully, a resolution that everybody can work with.
Yeah, couldn't agree with you more. As long as it's a good deal, I'm all for it, and I cannot thank you enough for the opportunity to share my perspective today. It's a lot of fun. Thank
you. You're welcome, Zach. Pleasure all the way. Take care. Have a great rest of your week.
Yeah, you too.
Zach Arnold joining us live from Los Angeles this half hour on Tomorrow Be Televised. When we come back, our brand new classic trivia question, our new prize or two in play, and I'll have some thoughts about the Black Friday that took place last week at ESPN and why it might be that channel is coming close to going over the cliff. And about a half hour from now, we'll be joined by Sherry Elwood, the creative executive producer of the popular CBC series Moonshine, coming to the CW tomorrow night. That's all ahead in the hour ahead, and we'll get it started after we pause after the top of the hour for web identification. This is www.blogtalkradio.com, speaker.com, and tune.com. Together, reach over 85 million listeners around the world every month and more. And, of course, the Red Star Show is a big, big thing coming your way on BTR. It's taking place tomorrow at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific. The Red Star Show. That's tomorrow, noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific, exclusively on Blog Talk Radio. Don't forget Best BTR coming your way 24/7 at YouTube.com. Welcome back to the second hour of Tomorrow Be Televised. Big two-hour edition coming your way on this Thursday afternoon, the 6th of July, 2023. Simon Abbott, I'm with you live from New York. 87 degrees top of the hour, and welcome to those who are just joining us at the top of the hour. Love to hear you. We got some comments, and we have a classic trivia question to have at you. So give us a call, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. The number is good anyway you're catching us across the country, around the globe, here on Blog Talk Radio, Speaker, or TuneIn Radio. And we've got our chat room available for you. It's SimonApple04 by name. You will find it at our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. While the promo is on the air, you can connect others by using Facebook Timeline. Click on the Facebook icon, your Blog Talk Radio speaker tune screen. Follow the instructions on the TV live with you. Coming up around the bottom of the hour, we'll be speaking with Sherry Elwood, the creator and executive producer of the new CW dysfunctional family saga, Moonshine. It's going to its third season later this year on the CBC. First season premiering tomorrow night, 9 p.m. Pacific time, on your local CW station, including WPX here in New York, marking 75 years on the air this year. Before we get to that, we have a classic trivia question for you. We had a winner yesterday, incidentally, and that was Andy Paulson from Bradford, PA, got the correct answer. So his prizes are coming his way, hopefully in the next week or so. And for our new classic trivia question, we have an AMC Networks-provided Uber card. That's right, an Uber card provided by AMC Networks. And we also hope to have, as a possible prize, from our last guest, Zach Arnold, who's an associate producer on Cobra Kai. He has his own firm now called Optimize Yourself. There's a book he's written called The Ultimate Guide to Making It in Hollywood. That's The Ultimate Guide to Making It in Hollywood, and hopefully we will try to get that in as a possible prize for the question you're about to hear. So get your thinking caps on. You could be our second weekly winner in a row if you have the answer to this question. Remember, Gidget started a series of movies from Columbia Pictures based on a popular novel. Sandra Dee was the original Gidget. James Darren was a star in the movies, which had several sequels. And then in the mid-60s, Sally Field made her TV and acting debut in a big way as the first TV Gidget, assisted by Don Porter as the father. The show ran for a year on ABC, did not do well the first time out. It was rerun over the summer, and then it became a hit. But unfortunately, by that time, everybody went their separate ways. So Screen Gems, which made the show, they're part of Columbia Pictures, could not get them back. However, back in 1986, there was a syndicated series called The New Gidget. It ran for two seasons in syndication, and herein lies the question. Who played Gidget on The New Gidget? Who played Gidget on The New Gidget? And I believe there are episodes of The New Gidget that are playing on YouTube. If you know the answer, email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. That's simonapple04@yahoo.com. Remember to enclose your name and where you are, your mailing address, when you email, so that if you win, we get the prizes out to you. Again, the question, who played Gidget on The New Gidget? If you know the answer, email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. That's simonapple04@yahoo.com. Remember, include your name and your mailing address in the email. If you are a previous winner or a previous guest on this program, you are not eligible. And if we don't get a winner by the end of today, we will post the question tomorrow morning on Facebook and Twitter. Facebook at Simon Applebaum, Twitter at UBC Simon, TWBT. That's Facebook at Simon Applebaum and Twitter at UBC Simon, TWBT. One more time, the question, who played Gidget on The New Gidget? It was a syndicated series from 1986. To 1988. 44 episodes remain. I believe some of them are on YouTube. So get in the game today. You could be our second weekly winner in a row and follow our winner from yesterday. But remember, in order to win, you got to play in. Do so today and all the very best. Coming up before the bottom of the hour, we expect to hear from Sherry Elwood, the creator and executive producer of Moonshine, the dysfunctional family drama that premieres here in the United States on the CW. It's a hit on the CBC, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. And it will be going into its third season later this year. But first, a comment. If you came in at the top of the hour, you missed our big new, big lead news note, which was that Susan Roebner, the head of NBC Universal's content operation, basically the head of NBC Universal programming, was laid off today. And it was part of a whole big executive upheaval at NBCU, where Donna Langley, currently the head of Universal Pictures, will be taking over Susan Roebner's role. When Michael Cavanaugh, the president of Comcast and currently the interim chief executive officer at NBCU, came out with a memo a short time ago this afternoon to all the staff announcing the departure of Susan Roebner without explaining why she was let go, she did get acknowledgement. We thank Susan for all of her many accomplishments at NBC Universal. Here's some of them, and we wish her all the very best in her future endeavors. The people, 20 or so, who were laid off last Friday at ESPN in what many folks in and out of the sports world are calling the blackest Friday in the 40-plus year existence of that channel, received no such acknowledgement. When ESPN last Friday came out with a statement about these layoffs, starting with Jeff Van Gundy, who was teamed with Mike Breen and Mark Jackson on the NBA Finals for years, including this last recent NBA Finals last month. Keyshawn Johnson, Jalen Rose, Max Kellerman of Keyshawn, J. Will, and Max, Susie Colbert, the long-running SportsCenter anchor, more recently NBA NFL Monday Night Countdown host, David Pollack and Gene Wojnarowski, members of the College Football Game Day on-air team, Todd McShay, second to Mel Kiper Jr. in terms of NBA draft coverage, also a college football sideline reporter and commentator, and others. The statement that was made by ESPN contained not one paragraph, not one sentence, not one word of acknowledgement. Not one. And this round of layoffs was not expected among the more than 7,000 that were planned initially earlier this year by the Walt Disney Company, ESPN's parents. This was all done by ESPN management led by Jimmy Pitaro. Every single one of those ESPN on-air people did a great job and should have gotten acknowledgement for it going out the door when they learned about their fate Friday morning. And what is really amazing is that some of the people who were laid off, like David Pollack, like Susie Colbert, like Gene Wojnarowski, who we learned about on 4th of July, had Twitter and Instagram notes that were posted that, to a T, expressed their gratitude to ESPN and their colleagues for what they accomplished there, were very optimistic about their next step, realizing the sort of when one door closed, another door opens. They showed more class than whoever put together that ESPN statement and ESPN's public relations and marketing promotion and everybody at that channel. They showed more class than ESPN did. What ESPN did had no class, had no acknowledgement, was absolutely insensitive. And it came at a time when, frankly, ESPN needs all the help it can get. As I mentioned on Sports News Wire yesterday on Sports Grid Network, ESPN is on the precipice of falling off a cliff. They are really on the precipice. Why? Because of the greatest development that has happened this decade and the decade last. The embracing by the American public, you out there, of smart TV sets, smart devices, and multi-channel bundles presented through those products to you. We are seeing more new networks, more new content going that way to you. And that is where the viewership is going, and that is where the advertising is going. And it is reaching the point where if you are a television network and cable and satellite is your primary way of reaching viewers, you are in big trouble. Why? Because more and more people are pulling the plug on their cable or satellite service. It has reached the point where the percentage of households with cable and satellite in the United States has gone from around 100%, 100 million people to 50 million people. And there are studies that came out last week that suggest that within 2 years, 2 years from now, middle of 2025, the percentage could be below 40% of all U.S. TV households, less than 40%. It was those subscription fees that ESPN and other networks collected from their local cable and satellite operators that allowed them to get into the original content business. And in ESPN's case, to buy the sports rights to the NBA, for the NFL, for Major League Baseball, recently the National Hockey League, and college football, college basketball, et cetera. And to expand their original programming, to get into ESPN Plus, which now reaches over 20, which has 25 million subscribers. That pot of gold is evaporating. And it's not just evaporating for ESPN. It is evaporating for a whale lot more people. That's why USA Network has gotten out of the scripted business. That is why, with rare exception, the Lazarus Project, whose executive producer we will have on this program Monday afternoon, why TNT is largely out of the scripted TV business, along with TBS, along with True TV. And it is calling into question whether or not, when the next round of NBA coverage rights is up for sale at the end of the 2024-25 season, why Warner Bros. Discovery, the parent of TBS, TNT, and True TV, and NBA TV, and Bleacher Report, and why ESPN may be out of the picture. Because dollars are now more critical than ever before. More critical than before. And there's something else that ESPN said in their statement, if you read it between the lines, that was equally disturbing. It was a threat to everybody else on air, whether you're a SportsCenter anchor, whether you are a college football, college basketball play-by-play person, or color commentator, or studio host, or studio analyst. You're expendable. You're expendable. When your contract comes up, if we don't like the way it looks, or we don't like your demands for an increased salary or whatever, you're out the door. No questions asked. We are going to really nitpick these contracts because we know we are under the bus, and you could be under the bus too if we don't like what you're proposing for a contract extension. That's why Jay Williams may be in the next few months out the door at ESPN as well, along with his fellow former morning show radio colleagues, Keyshawn Johnson and Max Kellerman. Yes, we knew that Max Kellerman might go out the door because of the Pat McAfee situation, and Pat McAfee taking over his time slot of this just in. We certainly did not expect Keyshawn Johnson to leave, or Jalen Rose to leave, or Susie Colbert to leave, or David Pollack to leave. That's what made this Black Friday so black at ESPN. The combination of they're out the door, no acknowledgement, just out, goodbye, like an NFL cut before the first regular season game. And that warning to everybody else remaining behind. ESPN, whether they know it or not, has got to understand that their whole mechanism of monetization must change. If they have any shot to stick around, they have to embrace smart TV sets, smart devices, and multi-channel bundles. And if it means that they have to get off cable or satellite entirely, that may be in the cards. Or whether it becomes all one service, whether it's ESPN, ESPN Plus, or whether it's just ESPN Plus, that's it. So be it. They have to find a survival mechanism. And that survival mechanism has got to happen, and happen fairly soon. And it's tough to say these words because I grew up covering the cable industry to cover networks like ESPN and USA and Nickelodeon and MTV and VH1. And look at the shape they're in. Look at the kind of original programming MTV is doing and VH1 is doing and Nickelodeon is doing. And Disney Channel, and so on and so forth. And again, it's because of the mega content services and the other services through smart TV sets and devices that we, the American public, are embracing. It's all coming the smart TV way. And goodness knows where it's going, because there are more and more people who want to launch networks. There are more advertisers who want to get involved. The smart TV set and device people are creating their own content and their own channels. Look at what Roku is doing. Look at what Tubi is doing as a multi-channel bundle, Pluto TV. Look at what LG and Samsung and Vizio are doing. So ESPN, whether you like it or not, you got to sound the alarm. However, where you go from here, do it with class. If you have to lay off more on-air people, do it with class. Really. The people who used to work for you, who left Bristol, Connecticut, and elsewhere last Friday, they deserve much better. They will make out, no question. and they deserve better from you. They didn't deserve to get a kick in the butt with no acknowledgement last Friday. Because there's a lot riding on how you treat people. And there will be a lot riding on how you treat people and the content you have going forward. I would love to hear what you have to say. By the way, Duck Northwest Media, who is a regular fan of our show, gave us a thumbs up just now. So, Duck, you have any further questions or comments about what we just said? You know, give us a call, 646-652-2906, or use the chat room, Simon Apple 04. I see we may have a call, so let's see if we will take it. Hello, you're on Tamaki Televised. What's your name and where you're calling from? Hello, you're on the air. All right. Let's see if somebody else is on the line. And by the way, we expect the next few minutes to be joined by Sherry Elwood, the creator and executive producer of Moonshine, the new television series premiering tomorrow night on the CW. So let's see if we have another caller. Let's go for it. Hello, you're on Smarty Televised. What's your name and where you're calling from? Moonshine, the new television series premiering tomorrow night on the CW. So let's see if we have another caller. Let's go for it. Hello, you're on. All right, who's on? Hello, you're on the air. All right. Apparently not, and we somehow had a reverb there. Let's try one more time. That was Duck Northwest Media. He says he's having a problem with voice over IP phone. All right, let's try it again. Duck, if you're on the line, let me know, or if somebody else is on the line, let's see. Hello, you're on Smart Be Televised. What's your name and where you're calling from? That person just dropped. Okay, call back, and as soon as you call back, we'll get you on. And, of course, we'll be joined very shortly by Sherry Elwood, the creator and executive producer of the new CW series Moonshine, which is doing very well in Canada, now its third season, or about to start its third season on CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. So, Duck Northwest, we're trying to get on the phone. Give us that call back. As soon as I see you're back on the line, we will get you on. In the meantime, we'll let you know we have a wonderful program coming your way to wrap up the week, our third of three episodes back to back to back. Joining us tomorrow will be the creator, co-showrunner, and executive producer of the new Prime Video series, The Horror of Dolores Roach, starring Justine Michaud. Remember her from the One Day at a Time revival? Aaron Mark, who has those titles, he will join us in our first half hour. And coming your way on Monday, we got a great hour to start the week for you. We will have, live from either New York or Israel, the chief executive officer of the interactive game service and content service PlayWorks, Jonathan Boltax, formerly the interactive TV guru at Cablevision Systems, now known as Optimum. Do you know that if you have Roku, you can now play Wheel of Fortune anytime you like, 24/7, using Roku and using PlayWorks? Jonathan Boltax will talk about that and about some of the other interesting content developments at that service, as well as the whole state of interactive TV, which seems to be moving in all sorts of interesting directions at the same time. Also on the program, from the Lazarus Project, TNT's popular new series, executive producer Joe Barton. That's all coming up Monday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, right here on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. By the way, if you came in late on today's program and you missed our first hour, I thought we had a terrific hour with Ross Feynman, the executive producer of The Lincoln Lawyer. Season two of that series began on Netflix earlier today. And Zach Arnold, the associate producer of Cobra Kai, chief executive of his own venture, Optimize Yourself. He had a lot of interesting perspective to point out about the writer's strike and where that may be headed, especially if the actors' unions, SAG and AFTRA, make a deal over the next week with the Alliance of Motion Picture and TV Producers. So if you missed that first hour, you want to catch up on the episode when we're done, go to our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. It's blogtalkradio.com/televised. Remember, you can check us out anytime you like on our growing number of podcast platforms, more than 20. We are on Spotify. We're on the iHeartRadio Podcast Network, the Zencaster Creator Network, Podvine, Verbal, iTunes, Apple and Google Podcasts, Acast, Amazon Music, TuneIn Radio, Speaker Podcast, Player.fm, PodcastWise, Podbay FM, Podchaser, Pod Paradise, our newest ventures of Podcast Addict, RadioPublic.com, Fathom, ListenNotes.com, and iBox, IBOOX. And, of course, you can also check us out on our wonderful website through On Podium. That's TomorrowWillBeTelevised.com. TomorrowWillBeTelevised.com. So remember, you can check us anytime you like on podcasts. Check out this episode, recent episodes. And if you go to our TomorrowWillBeTelevised.com website, we have a question box for you. If there's a topic you'd like us to tackle, a question on television that you'd like us to address, put it in the box, let us know, and if we use your question on the air, you, of course, will get the credit. That's, again, tomorrowbetelevised.com. And, again, thank you to the fine folks at On Podium for making that happen. Again, thank you to Dustin Northwest Media, one of our regular listeners who gave us a thumbs up on our episode so far, and I guess on our comment about ESPN. I'd love to hear what you think, incidentally. So email me if you can't get through today. Email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. It's simonapple04@yahoo.com. You can find me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter and LinkedIn as well. And also want to let you know that I do a commentary on the world of TV sports every week on Sports Newswire. That is available on smart TV sets and smart devices through Sports Grid Network. It's also available on Amazon Free, the end of the multi-channel bundles. The program runs from 11 to noon Eastern. That's 89 in Pacific time. Craig hosts it from Florida. I'm in New York at the Hotel Renaissance near Verso, a wonderful restaurant. Great for lunch, dinner, anytime you like. So check it out. Sports Grid Network on Amazon Free, the other multi-channel bundles, as well as smart TV sets and devices through Sports Grid Network. All right. Coming up, we will have our final guest of the day, and I believe that person may be ready to go on. Let's see. Let's see who it is. Let's see if that is Sherry Elwood, the creator and executive producer of Moonshine, which tomorrow night premieres, makes its U.S. debut on the CW, 9 p.m. Eastern and Pacific time. Hello, you're on Tomorrow Be Televised. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Hello, Simon. It's me, Sherry.
Hi, Sherry. Good to hear you. And first of all, congratulations on making it on CW. How's everybody up in Canada? Where are you calling from, first of all?
I am calling from Canada.
Where? Montreal, Toronto, Vancouver?
Nova Scotia. Nova Scotia, Canada, where I like to spend summers and where we shot the show, incidentally.
I've seen the trailer for it, and it does have that great Nova Scotia countryside on. First of all, what's it like to finally have your show after two seasons on CBC and a third on the way appear here in the U.S. on the CW?
I mean, we're psyched. My cast and crew, everyone's very excited to finally get a goodly number of eyeballs on our show. Yeah, we're excited to share it with everybody.
And in the Rotten Tomatoes, they had this to say about your show, that it's an epic tale of luck, legacy, and lobster. What do you mean, oh no?
Yeah. Oh, I don't know. I don't like to read reviews, Simon. Come on, I'm an insecure writer. We don't look at that stuff.
that's a nice sum up of the show. You know, dysfunctional family drama.
That basically sums it up. Yeah, it's a big, messy, dysfunctional family soap with some mystery and intrigue thrown in, and a really big cast of crazy characters near and dear to my heart.
Well, let's get into it. What inspired Moonshine in the first place?
Well, funny story. You know, the show is about the family that runs two stars on a good day resort on the south shore of Nova Scotia, which my family, my real family, happens to run a two stars on a good day summer resort on the south shore of Nova Scotia. So, a little bit autobiographical. We like to say semi-autobiographical so my family doesn't get mad at me.
Hmm. Well, when you put a show together like that and it's somewhat autobiographical, you have the sense of like how far you can go, at least in creating the show, without upsetting your clan.
Yeah, you know what? Comedy is a great place to sit in because the thing about sort of using real people as your inspiration is they never really think it's about them, especially if you're, pushing the situations and the character traits just a little, north of center. I was worried. I was a little worried in season one, but I sat my mother down, sat the clan down, showed them the pilot, and they were okay. There was enough laughs and, deviating from the truth just enough that they were okay.
You're hearing Sherry Elwood. She is the creator and executive producer of Moonshine and Tomorrow Night, the series that runs on the Canadian Broadcasting Company, a.k.a. the CBC, will make its U.S. debut at 9:00 p.m. Pacific time on your local CW station. When we come back, we'll have more with Sherry, and we want to hear from you. Give us a call or use our chat room. It's all coming up after we pause at the bottom of the hour for web identification. This is www.blogtalkradio.com, speakertocommonsoon.com. Together, reaching over 85 million listeners around the world every month and growing. On Sunday, a big soccer game. The United States plays Canada in the Gold Cup. And coming your way on Blog Talk Radio, we'll have a post-game show for you. That's this Sunday night at 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific. The Gold Cup post-game show following the quarterfinal match of USA versus Canada. That's Sunday, 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific, exclusively on Blog Talk Radio. Don't forget, Best We Charge 24/7 at YouTube.com. Welcome back to our final half hour, this two-hour edition of Tomorrow Be Televised. Those of you who are just joining us at the bottom of the hour. And once again, we are joined by the creator and executive producer of the new CW series Moonshine, premiering tomorrow night, 9:30 Pacific time, Sherry Elwood. So, Sherry, talk about the road you had from making this a creation inside your head to getting first on the CBC 2 years ago and now the CW.
Well, you know, I was working in a show, which little show you may have heard of, Lucifer, in Los Angeles, and I got a phone call from, spending every summer basically, sweating the devs on the Warner Brothers lot in Burbank, and I got a call from, producer colleague of mine in Canada, Charles Bishop, who I've known from, I've just known him forever. I'd never worked with him before, and he said, "Do you have any interest in, writing a show about Nova Scotia, set in Nova Scotia?" And I actually wrote an op-ed piece about this. I quite literally burst into tears because it's been so long since I was able to spend any time at home and see my family. And so I had always had this idea of, immortalizing the Klan, in this show. And so I pitched it to Charles. I said, "I actually think I wrote this up somewhere." And I had, like a 10-page document that I had written years ago, and I sent it to Charles, and he called me 2 days later and said, "Well, I sold it. We're going to be making the show for the CBC." So it was really, but that's where the easy part ended. And so we wrote the scripts, we got a green light, and, a couple weeks later, COVID. I mean, same old sob story for so many producers that I know. And so we were actually one of the first shows to go to camera in Canada. And we just, it was a mess. It was a mess. Everyone was terrified. I had to cast, it's a very large cast on this show, 15 regular characters. And I was not able to meet even one of them, even my lead, Jennifer Finnegan, the amazing Jennifer, in person. I cast everybody by Zoom. My writer's room was a Zoom room. It was a real roll the dice. I had no idea what was going to happen. What was great was when we actually found ourselves in Nova Scotia, we shot at my parents' property, but of course it was, an operating business at the time, so we built our own little back lot. What I found was that we became a bubble. There was really nowhere to go. It's quite rural. Because of COVID, we kind of stuck together. And so my cast family, my actors playing my real family, they became a real family. And I really think that in many ways that was a blessing because we all became extremely close, the cast in particular, the crew. And, we kind of made this show in a little vacuum. The executives were not allowed to visit set. We had very little interference, for better or for worse. And, and then we just kept rolling. We got a quick green light for season two in Canada, and then again for season three. And it feels like I've just kind of come out of a little bit of a fog in making this show. So, being snapped up by the CW is really a lovely cherry, on top of all of it.
If you have a question or comment for our guest this half hour, Sherry Elwood, the creator executive producer of Moonshine, which premieres tomorrow night at 9:10 p.m. Pacific time on your local CW station, give us a call. The number is 646-652-2906. 646-652-2906. The number is good anywhere you're catching us across the country, around the globe. You're on Blog Talk Radio, Speaker Tune Radio. Or get into our chat room. Duck Northwest Media is already in the room. Gave us a thumbs up already on the episode so far. So you can join him at SimonApple04. That's the name of the chat room. You'll find it at the homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. When you were casting the program, as well as the production crew and your fellow writers, given the COVID situation, did you want, along with Charles Bishop, to have people from the Nova Scotia area or nearby to be involved so they could bring their feelings about the area to your creation?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I've actually worked a lot in Nova Scotia selfishly because I like hanging out there so much. And so anytime I've had an opportunity to bring a production there, I've brought a production there. I even shot my first short film there many years ago. And a feature. So I've known the crew since I've been in my early 20s. So it really felt like my family was, my work family was actually helping me make the show. And the entire community got involved. It was a really big deal that a TV show is coming to, you know, little Hubbard's, Nova Scotia. Local restaurant owners, you know, we put our cast up in, you know, local homes. You know, it was a doors open policy, and everybody was tangentially involved in the making of this show in some way, and I hope that comes across. You know, the old adage, the more specific you are, the more universal the story becomes, so I'm hoping that comes across.
What comes across, I was watching the trailer to the program earlier this afternoon, is two things. One, very diverse area, people, but also a very diverse landscape. And you got the sense it's very, that the family and the environment is very rustic. Is that a fair thing to classify?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's very rustic, to say the least. The real place and the fictional place. Rustic but beautiful. I mean, one of the reasons I love this part of you know, the country, the nation, is that it hasn't really been gentrified yet. And I love that about it. I mean, Nova Scotia in particular, kind of populated by, you know, draft dodgers in the 70s and artists and musicians and writers and poets. And it's just a very, very interesting place where, you know, a lot of people go to hide out. And a bit of a secret that we don't really want anybody to know about. My strategy is working.
Uh-huh. Well, what was the strategy in terms of bringing your family into the plot as this dysfunctional, fictional family?
What was the strategy? What was my – oh, God, there was no strategy, Simon. There was no strategy. I said, woo, let's make a TV show, and then knew that I would have to sort of deal with the fallout later. The strategy wasn't just – okay, I'm going to tell you what my emotional strategy was. You know, I had worked on a lot of shows previously. You know, I'm generally hired as the dark comedy person, so viewing the world through a jaundiced lens has been my stock in trade. And I was just really ready for, yes, the show is crazy. Yes, you know, as you'll see on the CW broadcast, a lot of F-bombs been bleeped out. But I really wanted to do a show about a family who, despite their flaws, despite, you know, the chaos, really, really love each other at the end of the day. I mean, no one's holding them prisoner at this place, but yet nobody ever leaves. Because it's about family, and it's about place, and it's about sort of the archaeology of where we're from. And I was ready for that, to tell that kind of a story.
Mm-hmm. Talk about the actors that are in this. You mentioned Jennifer Finnegan. I think if people don't know about her, I think they will starting tomorrow night.
Oh, my God. Jennifer's amazing. Jennifer's originally from Montreal, so there's a bit of a Canada connection, but I had not known Jennifer before. You know, I had watched her on Amazing So She Did Salvation, and she had heard about this project through her manager and got her hands on, you know, the script, and it became, you know, she stalked me a little bit, and I'm really glad that she did, because I just can't imagine anybody else playing that part. She brings so much depth and funny to, you know, kind of a tragic character, and yet she just cracks me up and makes me cry, you know, in every episode. You know, she stars alongside Emma Hunter, who is a brilliant comedian, actress, Anastasia Phillips, brilliant. CW fans may have seen her on the television program Moraine, really good, plays a very different character, Tyrant, in this show. She's just amazing, and you're going to be terrified of her. Tom Stevens, who's wonderful, Alexander Nunez. So that makes up the core band of siblings, this, you know, adult blended family of half-siblings. And then Peter McNeil and Corinne Coslow, who play their, you know, aging hippie parents who want to try to offload this business to one of their offspring. And yet no one's quite fit to do the job. You know, when I pitched this, you know, the log line was blue-collar succession. And, you know, we got a nice mention in the New York Times the other day where someone kind of, where the reviewer cited that, not prompted. It made me just very, very happy. Not to use, you know, moonshine and succession in the same sentence, but that was always my intention. So it made me very
happy.
Do you
wear that as a badge of honor, given the huge success that Succession has been?
Oh, yeah. Definitely. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons that show was so successful. It's really, who cares about the money? It's all about a fucked up family trying to please their parents. You know, who doesn't know that story? Who can't relate to that?
How much face time did your cast have with your family? Did they sort of, how inquisitive were they in terms of, you know, asking them, how do you live your life? What inspires you? What hurts you?
Well,
what makes you laugh? All of those wonderful basic questions.
I think a lot of those conversations happened without my knowledge. I can say that with utmost certainty because, you know, there was always a family member wandering around, you know, if they weren't on set, they were set adjacent. So there was a lot of FaceTime that took place. I probably didn't know about, and I think had I known about it, it would have, I don't know, maybe, I tried not to think about it too much because it all became very meta at a certain point. I would see, you know, my parents driving by on their golf cart off to do, you know, some campground-related activity while my actors in the fictional golf cart would be driving in the opposite direction. So it was a little mind-blowing at times.
Moonshine premieres on the CW tomorrow night, 9 p.m. Pacific time, after the second season premiere of Family Law, which we covered on this program last year with the creators and executives of that program. And, of course, CW is available all over the country. It will also be running on the CW app, which is available more and more on smart TV sets, smart devices, and multi-channel bundles. We're speaking this half hour with Sherry Elwood. She is the creator and executive producer of Moonshine, which is going into its third season this year on CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. And she joins us from where the show is produced in Nova Scotia this half hour on Tomorrow Be Televised. Tom, I'm with you live from New York, which is down below Nova Scotia, from Canada to the U.S. of A. 87 degrees, the bottom of the hour. Love to hear from you. Give us a call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04, by name Duck Northwest Media, already in the room. We have more and more episode of our threesome to bring you. That's tomorrow, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific. And joining us will be, in our first half hour, the creator, co showrunner, executive producer of the new Prime Video series starring Justine Machado of One Day at a Time Revival fame, the horror of Dolores Roach, already getting great reviews through Rotten Tomatoes. Aaron Mark will be with us. And next Monday, we'll have the chief executive officer of the fast-growing interactive game and content service Playworks, Jonathan Voltax. And from TNT's new hit series, The Lazarus Project, we'll be joined by executive producer Joe Barton. That's all coming up tomorrow and next Monday, 3 p.m. Eastern Pacific, right here on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. How much of the storylines deal with the whole idea of preservation, preserving culture, preserving values, preserving lifestyle?
Quite a bit. I would say subtextually, almost the whole show is about that. It's about preserving something that's very special, and that's the Moonshine Resort and Campground that families have been going to for generations. And there's a real push within the community, our fictional community, Foxton, to get rid of this place, that it's a blight. They're never going to get the cruise ships, you know, with this dump on the horizon. So I try to, you know, and I do think that's important, And, you know, as I said previously, one of the things I love so much about going to Nova Scotia is that it hasn't been overly gentrified. What's special about it? You know, in the winter, pretty miserable. In the summer, it's absolute magic. And there's something that I think very relatable about that notion. Everyone remembers going to summer camp or spending time with their family at the lake. And that's the feeling I try to infuse in the show. So, yeah, I'm not bashing people over the head about, you know, anti-development and preservation, but really it's the heart of it. That's part of one of the main things that this show is about.
Some of the best television shows, some of the best movies use local characters, local people, as more than just extras to sort of give the program flavor or give the film flavor. How much of the locals, the non-actors, did you use in Nova Scotia, in your area, on your series?
Every extra, every character with just a couple of lines. We got big group scenes because, you know, at our resort there's a big dance hall where there's live music every Saturday night. That place is populated with the locals or, you know, people staying on the campground. You know, they all had, summer jobs on our show because they would, you know, just show up. And wardrobe loved it because they looked authentic. We tried to do that wherever possible. And you know, amongst our main cast, there are locals. You know, four or five that lived in Halifax, which is the closest big city that we cast to be on the show. Very important to me, anyway. Initially, anytime a project rolls into town, the local actors, you know, they start grumbling. And this time they were pleasantly pleased.
When you organized your writer's room, not just for the first season, but for the seasons after, how much did you encourage your writers to, A, talk to your family as possibilities for story ideas, but also to investigate their own family backgrounds as possible inspiration for episodes?
Oh, yeah. A lot. Believe me. We mined all the nooks and crannies of the collective family dysfunction. It was the writer's room was a very fun and sometimes cathartic place to be on the Moonshine Television program. Yeah, I really try to encourage that. I mean, whenever I'm casting a writer's room, you know, it's not so much to emulate my voice. It's about what they're bringing to the table, what they relate to in the core concept of the show, and how to be additive.
We're speaking with Sherry Elwood. She is the creator and executive producer of Moonshine. It's the new CW series that is already a hit on CBC up north, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, and going to its third season there later this year. First season begins tomorrow night, 9 p.m. Pacific time, after the second season premiere, Family Law, on your local CW station, Queen WCX here in New York. And if you have a question or comment remaining this with Sherry, give us a call, 646-652-2906, or use the chat room, SimonApple04 by name. If you came in late on today's program, want to catch up on episodes you missed, go to our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. That's blogtalkradio.com/televised. If you're having a problem with that, what you got to do is go to blogtalkradio.com, click on category, scroll down to entertainment, and then click on our logo on the episode that you want to see. Don't forget, you can also catch up on episodes at our website, blogtalkradio.com. On the Vine, People on Podium. And we're on more than 20 top podcast sites, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iTunes, the iRadio Podcast Network, and the Zencaster Creator Network. What do you think about how Canadian television, especially scripted shows, are being done? You know, many years, way back when, Canada was considered like second class to U.S. production. But certainly because of shows in recent decades, from Flashpoint to Due South to Sullivan's Crossing, which will be premiering on the CW later this fall. There seems to be more and more, and because of the fact we had a lot of CW shows being produced in Canada, particularly the shows of Greg Berlanti, like The Flash and so forth, that there seems to be a feeling now that, hey, if a show originates from Canada, it's as good as anybody in the United States or anywhere else in the world.
What do I think about that? Well, you know, that's great. that's great that the perception of Canadian TV has changed. Canada was traditionally used as just a sub for other, you know, larger Toronto and Vancouver in particular, just, you know, the stand-in for, you know, New York, L.A. And we're seeing a lot more TV now where Canada's proudly just being Canada, which is great. I think the world perceives Canadian television differently. I don't know if Canada perceives Canadian television as good as the rest of the world. That's something that myself and my writer colleagues talk about all the time. It's like we need to you know, go outside of Canada in order to be considered success still, which is, I don't know, maybe it's because from the British tradition, tall poppy syndrome. But yeah, I'm glad that you think that it's changing. That's nice to hear, because we certainly work really hard and sometimes for a lot less money. So yeah, that's good to hear.
And in fact, this summer is going to be a big summer in terms of Canadian shows getting their U.S. due on the CW, because it's your show. There's going to be the comedy from called Son of a Critch, which I have seen the trailers for. It looks like a very funny show. There's Run the Burbs, Children Ruin Everything. I mentioned Sullivan's Crossing coming on this fall. There's a couple of other Canadian shows or shows originating from Canada will be presented on the CW this fall. And so it looks like you know, your country is going to get a very big showcase of great talent.
I know. It's great. It's great. And I hope that audiences are just watching them as shows and not as Canadian shows. How about that? That's my wish.
And just to let you know, Sherry, we have had over the years on this program a lot of the people behind some of those shows. I mentioned Flashpoint. We had the couple that put that together, Mark Burns and Stephanie Morgenstern. We had the Family Law people last year. We had Transplant, the creator of that show, which did very well on NBC, and maybe coming back for another season there, too. We know that you have super talent up there, and they can come up anytime with really great stuff.
Yeah, hell yeah. Yes, we can.
Mm-hmm. When CW had their press conference here in New York back in May, both Dennis Miller and the head of the network and Brad Schwartz, who is the head of content, both said that ultimately they would like to co-produce shows with like Sullivan's Crossing and so forth, to have it be a true U.S. Canadian co-production. Have you heard from Dennis and Brad and their people about future seasons of Moonshine and how you see them getting involved?
No, not yet. Hopefully that's a conversation that will take place. That would be fantastic. You know, I think that all probably hinges on how audiences receive our, you know, left-of-center dramedy premiering tomorrow night. I do have another show that's in development with CW, which I'm really excited about and can't talk about quite yet. Yeah, I think that's a fantastic strategy. I'm all for that strategy. A plus.
Mm-hmm. How did the Lucifer experience help you get Moonshine off the ground? Because it, Lucifer is sort of a far cry in a way from Moonshine, whether Lucifer is like a straight drama, a genre drama, and Moonshine is more dysfunctional. You have elements of both comedy and drama.
Oh, well, I got to call a little BS on that, Simon. Lucifer, very funny show. Really one of the funniest characters I ever had the pleasure of writing. Lucifer is a very funny guy. And at the heart of that show, you know, put the genre components aside, it's about a dysfunctional family. It's about, you know, Lucifer's, you know, twisted and fraught relationship with his parents. So I think there's a lot of similarity. And if, you know, maybe if I'm known for anything, it's writing funny dysfunction. So, yeah, I think there's maybe a little more in common than, you know, at first blush.
And what is your family
was a blast
after two seasons of this show in Canada, this first season going on CW right now and another season to go and maybe more?
What does my family think?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, you know, it's funny. You know, we don't really have long sort of deep discussions about the content itself. They're just so happy. They gather as a clan and they watch the show. They watch it on linear, you know, with all the old folks in the community. And they're just so happy to see their town reflected accurately on TV. That's that's what they talk about, and that's how they feel. They feel pride at their little corner of, you know, paradise, you know, being broadcast to, you know, the rest of the country and now the world.
And before you go, in this first season, is there a particular storyline that you and your production team are particularly excited about, or particularly, you know, think will hit home with people here in the United States?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a story of coming home, and it's a story about a woman who's at a crossroads in her life, a very funny, fraught crossroads, but, you know, I think that's something really relatable, in particular to, you know, female audiences. You know, if I could say, what else is this show about other than this, you know, family as a whole in this community? The tale of these women trying to reinvent themselves. And that's something I think is relatable to pretty much everyone. You know, we all get to a certain point in life and it's like, okay, now what now?
The program is Moonshine, and you can see it on the CW tomorrow night, 9 p.m. East Pacific Time, right after the second season premiere of Family Law. And if you want to hear the episode that we did with the producers of Family Law, go to our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. You can also go to tomorrowbetelevised.com, our website. Check your local listings to the CW station, your area, including WFX TV here in New York. And for more details about the program online, go to CWTV.com. It's CWTV.com. And in case you, and if you don't catch it at 9 p.m., you can catch it later on the CW app, which more and more is available to you on smart TV sets, smart TV devices, and multi-channel phones. Once again, Moonshine, tomorrow, series premiere, 9 p.m. Pacific time on the CW, and third season premiere coming soon on the CBC. Anyway, Cheryl Elwood, thank you. Sherry Elwood, thank you so much for coming on the program today. Congratulations on both your success at the CBC, your success here on the CW. Hopefully tomorrow night is the beginning of a great long run, not just on the CBC, of course, continuing, but also here in New York and around the country on the CW. And we'd love to have you back to talk about your next CW project, which I'm sure will be a great one. It's been a terrific time having you here.
Thank you, Simon. I really, really appreciate it.
You're very welcome, Sherry. Take care. Have a great time with the premiere tomorrow night, and all the very best. Take care.
Thank you. Okay, bye-bye.
Sherry Elwood, creator and executive producer of Moonshine, joining us live from where the show is produced in Nova Scotia, Canada. Thanks to all of our guests for being here, all of you for tuning in. Remember, tomorrow we will be back with The Horror of Dolores Roach, creator, co-showrunner, and executive producer Aaron Mark. And then on Monday, the head of Playworks, Jonathan Boltak, and the executive producer of The Lazarus Project, the big new TNT scripted hit, Joe Barton. If you came in late on today's program, want to catch up an episode you missed, go to the homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. Check out our podcast, more than 20 podcast platforms. Take it, and remember, if there's a podcast platform near you, go, go, go for it after we're done, as well as tomorrowbetelevised.com, our website from the fine folks on Podium. Love to hear from you. What do you think of our program today? What about our guests? What's your thoughts where TV is at and where it's going, including my thoughts on ESPN at the precipice of a cliff, and also the situation with the Writers Guild strike? Let us know. Email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. Find me on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. However you respond to me, I respond back to you within 24 hours. That's our promise to you, because what you say matters now more than ever. The views expressed are those of the participants. They are not fair those of Blog Talk Radio and other distributors of this program. Andy Toe is BTR General Manager. Jay Soderberg is Head of Content. Website certified by On Podium, the Internet's new podcast outpost. Guitar Bacon is our web coordinator. For Tomorrow Be Televised, I'm Simon Applebaum in New York. Thank you for your listening. Have a great rest of your Thursday. We'll be back tomorrow with that man from The Horror of Dolores Roach, Aaron Mass. 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, you know where. Blog Talk Radio, Speaker Tuner Radio, and our podcast and web destinations. Whatever you're up to between now and then, please make it safe. Make it great. Stay cool. If you're in a hot spell, please stay cool the best way you can. We will all get through this. Until the next time, stay well and stay tuned.